Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Just before Christmas 1902, Alfred Knapp strangled his wife in her sleep. He put her body in a box and sent the box floating down the Great Miami River, telling everyone that Hannah had left him. When the truth came out, Knapp confessed to four other murders. Newspapers across the Midwest sent reporters to interview the handsome strangler. Despite spending most of his adulthood in prison, he had a charming, boyish manner that made him an instant celebrity serial killer. True crime historian Richard O. Jones examines the strangler's alleged crimes, the family drama of covering up Knapp's atrocities, and how a brain-damaged drifter became a media darling. The book we're featuring this evening is The First Celebrity Serial Killer in Southwest Ohio, Confessions of the Strangler, Alfred Knapp, with my special guest, true crime historian and author, Richard O. Jones. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Richard O. Jones.
Thanks for having me, Dan. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much. Incredible story. Let's talk about your background in journalism and a little bit about how you came to be the author of The First Celebrity Serial Killer in Southwest Ohio. What brought you to this story?
Well, basically, I spent my first career, 25 years, as a reporter for my hometown newspaper, the Hamilton Journal News. And part of my coverage was, it was pretty broad-ranging stuff. I did arts and entertainment mostly, but I also did the cultural institutions in town, the historical societies and things of that sort. And so in doing the job, I kind of developed a interest in local history, and I ran across Alfred Knapp as I was, he was just kind of a common thing in Butler County, Ohio, because he was our first electric chair case. I'm getting ahead of myself here, but he was our first electric chair case in Butler County. And so I was kind of known about him, you know, through that little tidbit of information. But about 2008, a friend of mine who had spent some time in Hollywood as a documentary filmmaker, he approached me to do a story. He wanted to do a documentary about another murder in Hamilton, the 1975 Easter Massacre, in which a fella, James Urban Rupert, shot 11 members of his family on cold, blustery Sunday after Easter afternoon. And he wanted to do a documentary about that. And so I started doing a ton of research into that. And just in the periphery of that was all these other murders in Hamilton through the ages. And this one really stuck out to me because of the, I call it Shakespearean. I wrote the book in five chapters because it just strikes me as a kind of a Shakespearean, very broad-reaching drama. Not only was there the murders that he confessed to, but because of the nature of the coverage, the newspapers from all over the Midwest descended on Hamilton, and they were all vying for, you know, some kind of hook or some kind of exclusive. So there was a lot of newspaper coverage, not only of the crimes, but also of his family dynamics and the things that were, other things that were going on in Hamilton at the time. And so as I started launching into this career, the second career of writing true crime, I wanted to do the Rupert book, which I did, but it's not published yet. But this one was a kind of a better sell for me, for the publishers I was working with, because of the real, truly historical nature of it, having taken place at the turn of the previous century. So that's a long-winded way of how I came about it.
Right. Let's talk about 1894 as you open the book and you feature Hannah Goddard, and she's 21 years old and she has two half-sisters, and she's going to Cincinnati for work. Tell us what kind of work is she doing and who she meets when she's in Cincinnati and what happens after that.
Well,
tell us how she ends up meeting.
Okay. She goes to work in a restaurant as a waitress, and one of the waitresses there was a lady by the name of Mamie King. She was the hostess of the restaurant where she worked, and she took Hannah and a couple of other young girls under her wing, so to speak, you know, gave them a place to live. She was married. Her husband had a really good job, and so she was just kind of taking care of these two young girls. And it was through her association, through Hannah's association with Mamie King, that she met Mamie's brother, Alfred Knapp.
What did she know about Alfred Knapp at that time? And who was he, basically?
Well, Alfred Knapp was kind of a strange character. His family traveled a whole lot when he was young, and it's not real clear why. His father was pretty much a common laborer. I think the most the biggest job he had was he was a conductor on a what they called it the incline. It was a streetcar that went up a hill in Cincinnati. But he grew up in various parts of Indiana and Ohio. He was the oldest of five children. There were three daughters and two sons. Alfred was the oldest of them. And he was kind of an itinerant drifter himself once he grew up. He had a penchant for getting in trouble. And he did several terms in prison. And when he met Hannah the first time, he was married to a young girl named Jenny that he had met in Lawrenceburg, Indiana. She was from Connersville, Indiana. And he had married her, and she stuck by him when he did a couple of prison terms. And she turns up dead in the Cincinnati Canal. And it was ruled a suicide, and it would come out that she was pregnant with Alfred's child and didn't know what to do about it. And he went into the Cincinnati Enquirer offices to put an ad in the paper looking for work. And when he came out, she was gone. And a couple of days later, they dragged her body out of the canal. And this is at the time that Hannah was living with his sister, Mamie, in Cumminsville, a northern suburb of Cincinnati. And he got to know Hannah through that association, and they married, despite Mamie's objections, they married about 6 weeks after Jenny Knapp was found in the canal.
Mm-hmm. So where did he find work, and how would you characterize this marriage?
Well, Alfred had this sort of fantasy that he wanted to be in show business. He worked for there were a lot of, you know, theaters and opera houses in Cincinnati at the time, and he would get work as a supernumerary, which would be, you know, if it's a big battle scene, they've got guys hanging around in, you know, Greek costumes and carrying spears. You know, they don't have any singing parts, but they have to be part of the background. So he got a lot of work with that. He also got a lot of work with, he worked for a couple of circuses that would come through town. And I guess the circuses they were talking about were like human oddities and things of that sort. And one of them had a beauty pageant as was part of their attraction. And Alfred would get into a lot of trouble creeping on the girls there. And he also got in a lot of trouble for stealing from people there. And so he did a couple of his, he spent 1 year pretty much in the Cincinnati workhouse as a result of his thievery. But he also did a lot of odd jobs, you know, just common laborer things, digging ditches and shoveling gravel. And when he was in Hamilton for a time, he drove a coal wagon that delivered coal to people's houses.
So what did Mamie and her husband, Ed King, they took in Hannah. What did they think of Alfred? And how much did they interact?
Well, Alfred was apparently a frequent visitor to their house. He was living in Cincinnati between his jail stints. He would often come to Cincinnati to live. His parents also lived there for a time. And his other sister, Sadie, operated a candy shop there for a time. So he was a frequent visitor to the King home. Ed King was not a big fan of Alfred. He just thought he was kind of a weird fella. And, you know, one of the things about Alfred that would come out later is that he took a couple blows to the head when he was very young. I think one time he fell off of a porch and was unconscious for a few days. And another time he was kicked in the head by a horse. And in fact, right, just to getting a little ahead of ourselves here, his lawyer had him cut his hair really short when he went to trial so that they could see the hoof mark that was embedded in the side of his head. So he wasn't a very bright fellow, but he seemed to have, you know, like these savant tendencies, in that he had a really good memory about things, and he would act out these stories, and he would write plays. Of course, he never got anything produced professionally, but this was just kind of the way his fantasy mind worked. Another thing about him that I thought was kind of interesting is when he was staying in Cincinnati, his companions were the children in the neighborhood, and he would hang out with them until he got into a little bit of trouble for doing things like throwing rocks at the women who worked in the factory when they came out from doing their job, you know, very childish things like that. So I think, you know, my opinion of it is that Alfred was kind of a, you know, a man boy, that he was, you know, kind of bright in some ways, but generally kind of a stupid fella and kind of clumsy and childish, I think, is the way that he comes across to me.
You write about August 8th, 1894, and there's a guy fishing, and he finds a body of a woman. Tell us what happens with this inquiry into who this woman that was found.
That woman, you're talking about his first wife, Jenny Knapp. Well, they fish her out of the body, out of the canal, and she had a lot of cuts and abrasions, and her head, injuries to her head. Most of that they attributed to, you know, being run over by the canal boats or the glass that was embedded, that was laying at the bottom of the canal and things of that sort. So when they didn't really do an autopsy, but the post-mortem examinations, they didn't see any real reason for a murder. In fact, Mamie King and his soon-to-be wife, Hannah Knapp, both testified at the coroner's inquest to Jenny's despondency, the fact that she was pregnant with Alfred's child and really didn't want to have a baby with him for obvious reasons. He couldn't hold a job. He was in jail, in and out of jail all of his life.
Right.
So it was ruled a suicide.
Now, you talk about they were married, and this is only 5 weeks after, you had mentioned, 5 weeks after Jenny's death, after her. So the couple winds up in West Indianapolis, Indiana, in the summer of 1895. And then you introduce 13-year-old Bessie Draper, and she had come to West Indianapolis from Terre Haute to live with her aunt. She wanted to get a job to send money back home. So tell us about August 29th and what happens with Bessie Draper, and who does she meet?
On August 29th, Bessie Draper met a fellow who was struggling to move a dresser in a wheelbarrow. And she helped him out, and he followed her around, or he kind of took her around through through a lot of back alleys and in West Indianapolis. And the further that they went, the more scared she got. And eventually, he led her down into a dead-end alley that had a stable. And she really got frightened then and took off running and escaped him. But she knew where he lived because she'd helped him deliver this dresser. And so she went to the police and told them of what happened. And so with one of the police matrons, they arranged a little sting in that she went to the house and she was going to signal to the matron if the man who came out was Alfred Knapp, and then they would arrest him. And so that's what they did. And they arrested him there, and he did another prison term for assault there, for attempted assault with her.
Now, you talk about this, he's 40 years old and he gets convicted and he's thrown in prison. He serves 7 years. Most of his adult life was spent in prison for petty larcenies and assaults on women and girls. What happens when he gets out of prison?
Hannah, he was married to Hannah at the time, and the last prison sentence he did was for assaulting a teacher in Burnett Woods in Cincinnati. And the story goes that he was just had this wagon that he was making some deliveries, and he just stopped and got out and started chasing this woman who was a school teacher. And he ended up going to the Ohio Penitentiary for that. And Hannah, to her credit, God love her, she stuck by him. And she was living again with Mamie and Ed King in Cumminsville when he was due to get out of prison. But the Kings didn't want Alfred to come and live with them. So Hannah moved back to Hamilton, Ohio, my hometown, to live with her uncle Charlie. And she was setting up house there. She had two half-sisters who lived there, and so it was kind of her home. So she moved back in with Uncle Charlie. So when Alfred got out of prison from assaulting this teacher, and they took a house on, they lived with Charlie for a little while, and then they took the upper floor of a house on South 4th Street in Hamilton, which happened to be next door to Hamilton Mayor Charles Bosch, Charlie Bosch. Mm-hmm. And Charlie Bosch thought that he was kind of a sweet but odd fella. He noted later on that when Alfred was driving his coal truck, as he would come down the street, he would ring the bell, or, you know, and if Hannah didn't come out to give him a little kiss, he would park his horse in front of the house and run in, and he'd be in there for 10 or 15 minutes, and then he'd come back out all chirpy and happy. And so they were living seemingly a really good life, you know, for who they were and for the time they lived in there on South 4th Street.
Pause for a moment for this commercial. You talked about everything seemed to be normal in this household with Hannah and Alfred Knapp, and he's got the mayor, this Bosch guy, thinking he's not such a bad guy. What happens next with Alfred Knapp?
Well, he's never really clear about why he did it. But one morning just before Christmas, he says he woke up in the middle of the night and strangled Hannah in her sleep. Now, if we kind of go back to his childishness, his childlike nature, I think he or someone else referred to it as he did it with giving no more thought than a boy pulling the wings off of a fly to see what would happen. And, you know, I don't know. He was never very clear about it, but that's what he did. He strangled her in her sleep, And then early that morning, he went around town. He rented a spring wagon, you know, just a, like a flatbed wagon and a horse. He went to a shoe store and got, they kept calling it a shoe box, but I'm guessing it was a crate that they shipped boxes of shoes in.
Right.
And took it back to their house on South 4th Street. And he got the box upstairs, but and he put Hannah's body and some other things in it. And it was too heavy for him to get it downstairs. She was a petite girl, but still, he had her all folded up in this box with some other stuff. And he couldn't get it down. So he even went so far as to hire a young man who was passing by and gave him a nickel to help him carry this box downstairs. And so the young man did. And then they saw him driving off in the spring wagon toward the river. He said he was going to deliver some stuff to Sims Corner, which was like a little village about 4 miles to Hamilton. He said he was going there, but he wasn't gone long enough to do that. And so when he came back and brought the horse and the buggy, the horse and the spring wagon back to the stable, they accused him of running the horse really hard. And he said, no, I did. I just got there fast, you know. And so he came back. Now then he went to visit the Kings in Cumminsville. And he gets down there and they see him coming up the walk, and he's going, and Alfred goes says to the Kings, well, where's Hannah? And they said, Well, Alfred, she's not here. And he thinks, that's odd. I was gonna meet her here. And so he stayed in town and celebrated Christmas with them, and there was a general presumption that Hannah had had enough and just left and didn't want him to find her anymore. So that was kind of the presumption that they had. After Christmas, Alfred goes back to Hamilton and settles up his affairs there. He sells some of Hannah's clothes to pay off the rent, and then he just kind of disappears for a while. With no sign of Hannah, and the Kings being very suspicious, especially Ed, he was very suspicious about what might have happened to Hannah.
What does he tell Edward to try to convince Edward that he's innocent? What was the indication? You said that Edward was suspicious, and so he does confront him and says to Knapp, "Where's Hannah? Why isn't hasn't she been here? Why isn't she here?" And so
right. He
explains about a note. So what is this note that he explains, and how convinced is Edward of his innocence or his guilt after this?
Well, he's not convinced. He's not convinced I'm trying to find the note here in my book. I'm sorry.
You write that he played along with Knapp's story and asked him to stay for supper. So he wanted again, question him, and as much as he could, he was convinced that Knapp was guilty, but he wanted to not, I guess, alert Knapp to the idea that he was totally suspecting him of this murder.
Yeah, and King's father was also staying with them at the time, and so he put Alfred and the father-in-law in the same bed, and told his father-in-law to listen in case he talks in his sleep, see if he says anything about Hannah. And they said that he did not spend, he was a very restless sleeper, but he never got anything concrete to tell him what had happened to Hannah. So that was kind of didn't really go anywhere for him.
You write that Knapp calls Hannah's half sister Linda Sterrett and asks her, "Have you heard the latest?" And told her that Hannah had disappeared. And he said that he got this information from a telegraph coming saying that Mammy was sick in Cincinnati, and Hannah had left to go there.
Hence
the idea that when he got to the Mammy and Edwards, is Hannah here? So he was at least consistent with that story in terms of trying to cover his tracks.
Right. Yeah, but he made a fatal error, though, in trying to convince people that Hannah had left him. And that was, he went off to Indianapolis, where his parents lived, and without getting a divorce and with nobody turning up, Alfred got married again.
Yeah.
And that kind of set off, major alarms in the King family, especially.
Now, as well, you talked about this marriage. Who is this person that he marries, and what does she know about his background?
Well, he married a young lady by the name of Anna Mae Gamble, and she was an acquaintance with his parents. They lived in the same block in Indianapolis. And she was also, a very childish woman. She was very petite, which seemed to be Alfred's type, probably because he could overpower him. He wasn't a terribly big fellow himself. But he married this young lady who just adored him. She was going to stick by him no matter what happened. So she married this young lady, and they moved into a basement apartment in Indianapolis that used to be a paint store, they said. And it was very dingy and dark. They lived there with her foster father, who was a Civil War veteran. And they lived there, and that's where they caught up with Alfred.
Mm-hmm.
How they caught up with him was Ed King, he was so suspicious that he enlisted a friend of his who was a railroad detective. Ed was a ventilation guy for the railroad, and so he knew this detective. And it's really funny. One of the papers told the story of him putting on this hideous disguise. Nobody in Hamilton knew him anyway, but he put on this wig and mustache. And I guess their method of investigating this report was to go to the various bars around town and ask around. And so they ended up getting quite drunk, and they went into a bar that was owned by a brother of a captain of detectives. And when the bar owner got wind of what they were there for and what was going on, he sent for his brother. His name was Thomas Linehan, the captain of police. And he heard their story, and he understood his suspicions that something bad might have happened to Hannah. But the only thing that they really had on him at this point was bigamy, because he had not gotten a divorce from Hannah, and here he was married to Anna Mae Gamble. And so Linehan took the 10:30 train from Hamilton to Indianapolis, and he rousted Alfred out of his bed at 4 o'clock in the morning with the help of Indianapolis police, and they brought him back to Hamilton on the morning train.
Now, in this questioning, when they finally get him to question him, there are not just the only Linehan, an instrumental person is this mayor, Charles Bosch, isn't it?
Yeah, Charles Bosch was in on it. The chief of police, I think the sheriff was there. There's a really famous picture that they didn't reproduce in my book. I wish they had, but it's on my website and so forth. Posed with these detectives, the safety director, the chief of police, the sheriff, Captain Linehan, and Mayor Bosch, all gathered around Alfred while he's signing this confession. There were a lot of people involved in that. Now they brought him in for bigamy, with the suspicion that he might have, because they didn't want to mess with trying to get an extradition or anything. And I guess he was simple-minded enough that when they said, "We want to talk to you about Hannah," he got on the train and came back with them. Well, the newspapers got wind of this. And before they got back on the morning train from Indianapolis, the Hamilton Sun, which was kind of the most tabloid of the three papers in Hamilton at the time, they had a big headline, you know, Knapp arrested for murder and all this stuff, arrested for wife murder, startling affair brought to light. And this came out before the train from Indianapolis got to town. So there was a crowd of about 300 or 400 people waiting for him at the station. And bear in mind that Alfred always had this fantasy of being in show business. And although he was just kind of a hand for the circuses he worked for, he told everybody that he was a trapeze artist. And so he kind of had this idea of wanting this kind of fame and adulation. And so when he came into Hamilton on the train and all these people were there, you know, he was, for him, that made quite an impression on him. And so they took him into the police station, and these five very high-powered officials started grilling him, started giving him the sweat, they called it, started giving him the sweat. And he was coy, you know. He wasn't telling them anything, but they would tell him something, and so one of the policemen would leave the room to go check it out, and that happened a few times, and it came down to it was just him and Charlie Bosch sitting in his office in Charlie's, the mayor's office together, you know, in Hamilton, the city building contained, you know, everything. It was just one building. So that's why the mayor and the chief of police and everybody was in the same building. And so having known Alfred before, from when he lived next door to him, Alfred, I know you got something on your mind. And Alfred said, well, I can't tell you what it is, but I'll write it down for you. And so the mayor gave him a pencil and a piece of paper, and he wrote out a confession that said not only did he kill Hannah Knapp, no, the first day he just said that he had killed Hannah Knapp, but he was very coy about it and kind of hinted that he had other things on his mind. And so after he made the confession, they took him out in a police buggy with all the press following along, and took him down to the river, so he showed them where he put the box in the river. It was a fishing hole that everybody liked to go to. He took him down there, and he was being very coy the whole way there and all the way back. You know, it's like, I got something else on my mind, but I don't want to tell you about it. And so the next day, they decided to put him through the sweat again because they suspect that he had also killed his wife, Jenny, even though it was ruled a suicide officially by the coroner. They had the inquest and everything.
Right.
So they thought that maybe he'd killed his wife, Jenny, too. And so the next day they gave him the sweat, and kind of the same thing happened all over again. Somebody would leave the room to go check out something that Alfred was telling them, and left him alone eventually with the mayor. And the mayor did the same thing. Charlie, or Alfred, I know that you got something on your mind. And Alfred said, well, I can't tell you, but I'll write it down. And so he gave him another pencil and piece of paper, and he wrote out the famous confession that not only did he kill Hannah, but he also killed his previous wife, Jenny, and he also killed two or three other young ladies in Cincinnati and Indianapolis. And so the Hamilton was about 20,000 people then, so it wasn't a real big city. And my take on this is that they really didn't know what to do with him, you know. And so when the word came out that he had confessed to these murders, that the press from Cincinnati and Indianapolis, and there was even some reporters from Chicago, I found some reports in the Chicago papers, they all descended on Hamilton, you know, like maybe 100 newspaper guys or so. And they didn't know what to do with him, so they gave the newspapermen pretty much full access to talk with Alfred and to get the stories of these murders that he says he committed.
Right. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second, talk about our sponsor, which is Ritual. We deserve to know what we're putting in our bodies and why. That's why Ritual's founder is on a mission to reinvent the vitamin industry. Kat Schneider and her team of scientists at Ritual are making clinically tested a new normal. Ritual left out mystery additives, synthetic fillers, and shady extras that can be found in some traditional multivitamins. My wife Lisa decided to take Ritual after reading all about their specific ingredients and the advantages of those as compared to other multivitamins, and decided to take Ritual Essential for Women. She's incorporated for about 6 months now Ritual in her daily routine of exercise and healthy eating, and she continues to feel it really is making a difference in her health every day. Ritual's clinical study of Essential for Women showed an increase in vitamin D levels and omega-3 DHA levels. For obsessive label readers, Ritual uses vegan-certified, non-GMO, gluten-free, and allergen-free ingredients, and their sources are out there for the whole world to see because they believe you deserve to know what you're putting in your body and why. Daily changes can lead to big results, so start small today. Ritual is offering my listeners 10% off your first 3 months. Try it out, satisfaction guaranteed. Go to ritual.com/murder to start your Ritual today. That's 10% off during your first 3 months at ritual.com/murder. Now, we're talking about an incredible time in American history of media when the newspapers were the only game in town, and they were a huge game, to say the least. And you talk about the incredible, it's amazing readingness, the access that these journalists, these media people had, and the kind of stories that they weaved and the headlines that they used in their newspapers. Tell us more about his dalliance with the media and the results in terms of headlines and newspaper articles.
Right. Well, as I said, I don't think they knew what to do with them. And this was before we had HIPAA laws and all this other stuff. And so they just gave them access. Now, one of my favorite scenes in the book, I think, is they take the reporters to his jail cell, and they were going to let him talk to him through the bars. But there were so many of them that they had to retire to the sheriff's dining room. Now, you know, back in those days, the sheriff typically, and this was everywhere, but especially in Hamilton, the sheriff had the house like right next door to the jail, and a lot of times they were attached to it. So they took him out of the jail cell and took him into the sheriff's dining room. And some reports even said that Sheriff Bisdorf gave him a cigar. And so they paint this picture of him sitting in this dining room, kicked back with his feet up on the table, regaling this cadre of reporters with these stories of murder and mayhem as calmly and as enthusiastically as if he were talking about, you know, a sporting event or something of that sort. So he just started weaving these tales about these young women that he had assaulted and murdered. And would do lengthy interviews with the Cincinnati Inquirer did, because there were two of the murders had taken place three of them had taken place in Cincinnati. So they were particularly interested because all these murders had been unsolved, and here was Alfred Knapp, this crazy little guy in Hamilton, Ohio, saying that he killed all these women. So the headlines were, you know, all over Indianapolis, Cincinnati, Chicago. All over the Midwest, they were telling these stories, and it got to the point where they felt like he was kind of stretching the truth a little bit. And in fact, they caught him at it one time after he'd been in there for a while. He started telling them about this time in Missouri when he was being chased by a posse and all this stuff. And one of the reporters said, "Hey, wait a minute, wasn't that just in this magazine?" And Alfred goes, okay, well, you caught me on that one. Telling these stories just kind of made the headlines across the Midwest were just sensational. When I wrote the scene in the book, I kind of took, because some newspapers would highlight, you know, the things that were of interest to their readers, and other newspapers would highlight different things. So you kind of put them all together and got a really good scene of what had happened that afternoon. in the sheriff's dining room there in Hamilton.
When he first was speaking to Krueger and the police chief and the sheriff, he was talking about. It seemed odd for the time, for 1904. It sounded like present day, where he talked about if you can't find a body. I thought this was very fascinating. What did he have to say about the prospect of being convicted? There was no finding of the body.
He didn't think he would get arrested. He didn't think he would get convicted. Is that? I'm sorry. It's been 5 years since I wrote this book, so.
Well, he just thought that he said to them initially when they were questioning him, he said, "If you won't be able to convict unless you find that body." And I just thought that sounds like a modern day thing for a criminal to say, not something for.
Oh yeah, the prosecutor was saying that too, though, that unless they got a body, he didn't know what they could do with it.
Well, of course, right.
And the prosecutor was a very well respected. Man in Hamilton, his father too. They were newspaper men. But his brother at the time was the publisher of the Democratic newspaper in Hamilton, and Warren Guard was the prosecutor on the
prosecutor.
Case. Yeah, and he also went on to become a judge later, and he also became a congressman later on, too. But, yeah, it was his contention that unless they had a body, he didn't think that they would be able to convict him of this, partly because his stories were kind of outlandish. And so I guess fortunately, a couple weeks into his incarceration, the body of Hannah turned up in New Albany, Indiana, some 150 or 160 miles from Hamilton. Was found by there was a ferry there, and as they were crossing the river, they found her floating in the Ohio River at this time. She had flowed that far. She was no longer in the box. They never did find the box, but they did turn up her body, and so then they had a case against Alfred Knapp for the murder of Hannah Knapp.
Something also very interesting, there was a case of two girls that were accosted, and they had a man named Roth, Joe Roth, I believe, in custody.
Yeah.
And yet Knapp had been questioned about this as well. Unfortunately, one of the girls had identified Roth, so this is a very interesting, I guess, side story, but very fascinating about the resemblance between Knapp and Roth and how they became involved even at the trial and then later near the end of the book or at the very end of the book. So let's talk about Joe Roth and these two girls, these two young girls that were accosted, and Joe Roth was in custody when they now have in custody this strangler, Alfred Knapp.
Right. Yeah, the two little girls, I think they were like 4 and 7 years old or something like that, very young little girls. And they had last been seen, their father owned a butcher shop, and they had seen them looking in a store window there, and then they kind of disappeared until they heard the screams. And the two girls came running. One of them was knocked unconscious, and the other one got away. And they brought in bloodhounds from Dayton to come down, and they ran around a part of town that was called Peck's Addition, which was a very poor part of Hamilton. It was a part of the city that was often flooded from the river. It was a low-lying area, often flooded. So, half of the years they would lose their crop. But nevertheless, you know, there was a very poor part of town. They grew melons and corn down there. And the bloodhounds led them around in a kind of circuitous route around Peck's Addition, and finally came upon the house of Joe Roth. And so they arrested him, and the older of the girls actually identified Roth as the man who accosted them. And so he was in jail, at the time that they brought Knapp in from Indianapolis. And they remarked at the time what a strange and curious resemblance the two had together. They were both smallish men with a swarthy complexion, and apparently they looked a whole lot alike. And Alfred had been questioned about this because of his criminal record, but he ended up testifying in the trial, but they could never actually pin it on Alfred, so they went ahead and prosecuted Joe Roth for the attempted abduction of these little girls.
You take us right into the courtroom with this case. And what was interesting is the one girl, I'm not sure if it was Hattie or the other girl, but she's, like you say, 6 years old. She is forced at that trial to go and identify him by walking up to him and putting her hand on his shoulder. It was incredible.
Yeah.
And at the same time, you also have testimony where the media believes, and maybe even the defense believes, or the prosecution believes, that there'll be worthwhile testimony from Knapp. But Knapp doesn't give them anything conclusive to help Roth's case whatsoever. And that's what you write. But I wanted to say is that his behavior, though, however, if I thought from reading, was that because he had that demeanor at court, uncooperative, took the fifth equivalent where he didn't want to answer any questions, in fact, because Roth was quickly determined to be not guilty and acquitted, I thought that, in fact, Alfred Knapp's presence at that trial actually helped Joe Roth inadvertently.
Yeah, probably did. But, they couldn't actually pin it on him. Like you said, he wasn't being very cooperative. And so they just kind of let that go.
Mm-hmm. Now, I wanted to mention, too, just for the readers as well, is that what you provide is a lot of source material, like letters that Alfred later writes, correspondence, the confession. But also what I thought was worth noting is the illustration of the murder in 1934 by the Evening Sun, and you provide a great, great reproduction of that. So I wanted to mention that that's part in the book as well, this incredible, the media, how they act in 1934, hard to believe. But anyway, I just wanted to mention that.
Yeah, well, one of the craziest things along that line is that the Cincinnati Inquirer, they published pictures of his hand. So that palm readers could take a look at that and determine whether he was guilty or not. So I think that goes along with how they were so desperate, to outdo each other, to one up each other in trying to cover this case. They not only did they go into his family history in so much detail, but they would do crazy things like that, like printing his palm so that you could read his palm and tell and. The hands of a strangler, I think, was the headline. It was great.
Yeah. You also have you chronicle the phenomena, basically, of having Alfred Knapp depicted in the media the way he did as well. So in terms of what happens with this trial, tell our audience who he eventually is. He retains an attorney, and who's representing him in this?
Well, his attorney is a young fellow by the name of Thomas Darby. And again, this is one of the subplots that I thought totally fascinating about it. That Thomas Darby, it was a young up-and-coming Cincinnati attorney. And he worked so hard on this case that he almost literally worked himself to death. And in fact, when they delivered the verdict, he wasn't present because he was so sick. And he would later go on to become a Hamilton County prosecutor. So he was this was like his big foray into big law stuff. So
tell us a little bit more about this trial and what is and part of the before this trial, there's always the investigation into the claims that he's made in this confession. He's made various confessions or has spoken to the media several times and said certain things. Were there inconsistencies that were given in the confession as opposed to what he said to the media? And officially, what were the records to support what Knapp had said concerning those four murders?
Well, you know, frankly, there wasn't a lot to actually connect him to these murders. Now, one of them, you know, we talked about Jenny Knapp and how it had already been ruled a suicide, but then he confessed that he killed her. But another one was the case of a young lady by the name of Mary Eckert in Cincinnati. And she was a Dayton girl who came to Cincinnati to get work. She had some connections there, but they weren't real strong ones. So she took a room in a boarding house next to the YMCA, I think it was on 8th Street in Cincinnati, and was looking for work. And one morning, a milkman was coming around, and I didn't know they did this, but apparently she just bought a ladle full of milk. And she didn't have any money, and so he just let her have it. But the milkman saw a kind of a strange character hanging around the fence at the time, and he took note of it. And so later that day, when she turned up dead, you know, the suspicion fell on this unknown stranger who was hanging around the gate. But the milkman went to the Butler County Jail to visit Knapp and said that he wasn't the guy. And so this mystery stranger, you know, remained a mystery. And in the case of, I believe it was Emma Littleman, she was found in a lumber yard. She was a younger girl. She was only like 13. And her father had seen her around the lumber yard that day, and he too had seen a stranger. And so he came in to look at her, and he too said, no, I don't know this man. So there wasn't a whole lot to connect him to all these other murders. So when he went to trial, it was purely for the murder of his third wife, Hannah Knapp.
Yeah, and you talked about they finally found somebody who had helped him carry the box downstairs. So they had that to confirm that he had certainly murdered Hannah, didn't they?
Right. Yes, they did.
What?
And of course, they had
the body
for her. And it was pretty clear that, you know,
Yeah. Also, what I was going to say is the phenomena that I was mentioning there before I lost my train of thought was that was interesting. It was the reasoning people thought that Alfred Knapp might not want to admit to the Motzer girls being accosted, since Joe Roth was been arrested, I guess, around that same time. What was the phenomena that we don't know of today, but is interesting to hear, that they said was the reason why Alfred Knapp might not want to admit that he attacked those Motzer girls?
Can you give me a little bit more on that?
It was lynching. It was the phenomenon of lynching.
Oh, the lynching. Okay, yeah. Yeah, the people were outside the jail. People were very upset when the Motzer girls were, you know, not abducted, but assaulted. He was afraid that that they were going to lynch him for that. So that was one of the reasons why he didn't didn't say anything about that and was kind of a contrarian at Roth's trial, even though they had him testify against it. And that was a real concern back in those days. You know, I do a lot of stories now about vigilante justice and people. In fact, the same year that this took place in Oxford, Ohio, which is near Hamilton, there was a case where two guys from came in during a festival and were shooting the place up, and they killed the town constable. And so the father of the constable led a crowd down to the jail in Oxford, and with sledgehammers, they busted him out. and they were going to hang him in the public square, but a deputy sheriff came along and saved him in the nick of time. So this was probably fresh on Alfred's mind too, you know, the case of the Spivey brothers and how they were lynched, attempted to lynch them. So this was a very, very real threat in those days.
Now, what we haven't talked about is that, of course, with this trial, the defense tries to pick or has to pick probable defense that might work, that may work with this. And so I'll ask you what route that they go in terms of their defense. But also that we skipped this fact was that when he went to testify for the Joe Roth trial, and in this trial as well, tell us what his demeanor was, but also how was he dressed? I'll just say that he was well dressed. You said that
he was
the best well dressed guy in the courtroom, and he was really and he was concerned about that. So he was important to him, and the media responded as well. You say,
right. Yeah, he seemed to be very well at ease, you know, in the trial. Their defense was basically an insanity defense. As I mentioned earlier, Darby had him cut his hair very close so that they could see that the horseshoe-shaped scar on his head from where he was kicked in the head by a horse. And they came out with all these stories about, you know, him accosting the young ladies and I guess he dropped a chisel or something on a group of people at one point. And so they brought out all these little things that he had done through the years to try and get this insanity defense. But it didn't work.
It did come down to getting prestigious doctors at that time. You write that one of them was somebody in the courtroom. He was a prestigious and important author. And he wasn't involved with the trial, but he was commenting and making his comments known to the media. So he was like he was reporting. You talk about that they brought everybody in his family, mother, sister, everybody to weave a story, to concoct, to say that he was normal. He was had a great disposition, and then he got kicked in the head at a young age, and then he fell off the porch, and then other things that they noticed that his nickname was Looney. And also peppered through this whole book is that he tells people stories like I'm a detective and shows them a crappy little badge and tells them he's an acrobat. So he's not taken seriously by some people with his stories. In this as well, you have a battle of the psychiatrists and those people trying to save Alfred Knapp's life. But as you say, to no avail, is it?
No, it's to no avail. He's pretty readily convicted of first degree murder, and they send him off to Columbus. He did momentarily get a retrial, but then that decision was overturned, so the retrial never happened. So he did come back to Hamilton at one point, but he felt like he had a way that he was going to beat the electric chair. He told one reporter that if he held his arms in just the right manner, that the electricity would just roll right through him and wouldn't kill him. So he was gonna beat it that way.
Right. All along the media, he cooperated with the media. What was his disposition with the media? Was he brave or fearful?
Oh, he wasn't. He was loving the attention, I think. That's why he kept coming up with these great stories. You know, and he had a pretty good memory because he got most of the dates and a lot of the details right on all these murders that he said he committed. So he had that going for him, but everything was so outlandish, and they tried the insanity defense, and they had the family pitted against each other. Mamie King and her husband, Ed, were the ones who, you know, got the ball in motion to have him arrested for getting rid of Hannah. But yet he had another sister, Sadie, who was very much his champion. And she went out of her way to try and, you know, tell these stories about him getting hit in the head and about the strange things he did to try and get him that insanity defense. And she was quite a striking character. And I spent quite a bit of time in the book, I think, describing her appearances. She first comes into the story when he's having his preliminary hearing, and the newspapers were just taken aback by this. She looked like him, but she was beautiful, you know, and she was very elegant and just dressed to the nines. And she was his champion. She really went to bat for him. And then when they gave him the death penalty, she tried really hard to, she wanted to be there for him. She wanted to be in the room. And eventually they just wouldn't let her do that.
We're going to pause for a moment for these commercials. You talked about Sadie and her unwavering, it seems, support. And we'll talk more about Sadie because she is such an important character in this story. But also Sadie blamed her sister Mamie and Edward right from the very beginning for turning him in. What was her sense? Why would she attack her sister for just doing something that was morally right? What was her idea about that?
I think it was mostly just her loyalty to Alfred. She knew that he was, you know, a simple-minded fella, and that, you know, he if he did kill Hannah, he didn't mean to, and if he did these other things, he didn't mean to. You know, that's just his nature, and that he should be given some latitude for that. You know, so she tried really hard to kind of smooth things over for him. Very little avail.
You write, too, what's interesting is the trial had huge crowds and interest, and the summation especially had overflowing crowds. Both of the attorneys, the defense, Darby, and the prosecutor, both did masterful, as you write, masterful summations and closing arguments. Tell us a little bit about just those closing arguments, what basically they had to say on behalf of and against Alfred Knapp.
Well, Gard said that they shouldn't be swayed by sentiment to save him from the electric chair. You know, his take was that society demands that he be put out of the way, and that the electric chair, which was rather new at the time, was a humane way of doing it. And Thomas Darby, is, as we mentioned, he literally worked himself sick. And as he was given his final plea in front of the judge and the jury, he pretty much collapsed. And when Warren Gard, the prosecutor, kind of caught him and helped him to the judge's chamber where he could recover. And so that was just, you know, one of the many dramatic moments in the trial. There was also a dramatic reconciliation between the two sisters outside the courtroom. So there was a lot of drama in there too. It was, you know, and so the crowds, yeah, they were thick. People were hanging from the windows and all that crazy stuff that they were doing back in the day to try and get into the courtroom. And it was very hot that summer too. So it was kind of a trying time for everybody.
We haven't mentioned, which is important too, and another side part of this story, very important, is his fourth wife, Anna May. Initially, what was her, what was she like with the media? What did she have to say to the media initially? And then as this trial was going on, where was Anna May?
Yeah, I think she's one of my favorite characters. She's another one of my, there's so many great characters in this book. As we talked earlier, she was kind of a simple-minded girl. And the first story where we get introduced to her, an Indianapolis newspaper man goes to their little dingy apartment to ask her if she had ever woken up in the middle of the night with Alfred Knapp's hands around her throat. That was his big question for her. And she was just infuriated with it. You know, she basically kicked him out, you know, and they describe her shrill voice rising out of the little basement apartment and going out into the street, and her decrepit old foster father, the Civil War veteran. They were living in this little dingy apartment on his pension, and how much he loved her, and they both loved Alfred, and she even went to Hamilton at one point, and there was a very big show of that. She took him some clothes and a clock, and they were afraid that she was going to try slipping in a weapon or a poison or something, so they kind of held back on some of the stuff. But she made quite a splash in Hamilton too, and she pretty much stood beside him as much as she could, but she did not come to the trial, and she kind of disappeared a little bit. I think she got remarried later, but she died very young. But yeah, she's quite a character. In fact, one of my presentations that I do at the libraries and stuff is I take the sections where we talk about anime Gamble Knapp and kind of make a story out of them just by itself. You know, it's very entertaining.
Mm-hmm. You say that defense attorney Darby, and this is unusual, he cried when the verdict was read, didn't he?
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, again, he what they called it brain congestion. I really don't know what that means, but he was sick, and so yeah, he was very upset. He took it very personally. I think that's what made him a great lawyer and why he went on to do good things. That he really took this case to heart, and he worked his butt off for Alfred Knapp.
Interesting, you write too that 80 women brought flowers to jail for the strangler.
Yeah, he was popular with the ladies, which kind of, you know, I mean, serial killers are very popular with people.
I guess,
and
yeah.
That's why I called him the first celebrity serial killer, because, you know, up to that point, there really wasn't, you know, such a thing, you know, a term as serial killer. Now, this is after H.H. Holmes and of course, Jack the Ripper and some others.
Right.
Some other things, but Alfred Knapp, I think, was the first one who really caught the public eye, you know, and got this adulation and adoration, especially from the women, you know, from the women in town, and they would come out, you know, dressed to the nines to come to see the trial, and they would just swoon if he looked in their direction and those kinds of things, and yeah, they brought him flowers And so he really made quite an impression on people, in spite of him being a simple, you know, and to my mind, a rather stupid fella. Apparently, he had a charisma about him that really captured people's attention and made people want to talk to him, whether it be the reporters or the women. You know, that they were kind of taken with Alfred. You know, they were kind of in love with him, Yeah, I guess he's not a bad-looking fellow. I don't know. I look at his picture, and he looks very sad to me.
Yeah. You write that the reporters finally tracked down Anna Gamble and at her new house. And meanwhile, with the reporters, there was 10 women were there, and they were taunting Anna. And she vowed, and she was real defiant. Right from the very first time she speaks to the media, I thought, geez, wow. Feisty, and she vowed to go see her husband.
But yeah, she said she would go to Hamilton for the trial, even if she had to walk. So of course, she didn't. But
yeah. Now, he heads off to Columbus, Ohio, and so right away, they don't fool around. He's the guy at the county jail, the warden, says, we've had enough of this circus for 6 months, and so he ships him off to Columbus, Ohio State Penitentiary, He's still talking to reporters there, isn't he? What's his demeanor by the time he gets there?
Well, he's still, he's still the same old jolly Alfred. You know, he doesn't seem to get upset or depressed about his situation, and in fact, somebody gave him an accordion, and so he was playing the accordion while he was waiting on death row.
Yeah, crazy.
I think his song was "There's a Hot Time in the Old Town Tonight" was the song that he played over and over again.
Well, you said too that the fellow inmates, the prisoners were horrified by his lack of remorse and the jokes he did about his crimes and his upcoming execution.
Yeah. Yeah, he didn't seem to have a bit of conscience about it at all. You know, he never really showed any remorse.
Something that might have upset him greatly was happened in September, and he finally heard from his fourth wife, who he called Annie, or pardon me, Anna, and Anna May. What did she say to him essentially in that, when she finally did get to speak to him?
She was not happy. I think she finally came around to realize that he had done some bad things, and the letter she wrote was rife with misspellings. But she said that she had received his letters and was glad to hear from him, but she was sorry that the way that he talked to her, and she expressed shame of herself. And kind of took the blame herself for his being unhappy to have to, you know, to do the things that he did. She wasn't going to get a divorce, and she encouraged him to cheer up, but she never did come to see him in the jail, or except for that one time in Hamilton. Never came to see him in Columbus. And did not attend his execution.
Now, when they set a new execution date, finally, is Alfred Knapp, what's his demeanor now? When it looks like there's no more, there's nothing left in terms of appeals, and he's going to die in the electric chair, what's his demeanor then?
Well, he does show a little bit of remorse for something. And he specifically asked Mayor Charlie Bosch to come to the execution, and he gave him a note that he finally confessed to the attempted abduction or the assault on the Motzer girls, and finally cleared Joe Roth of the suspicion of that. So he finally did clear that one up. I think that's what you're getting at, right?
Yeah. Well, he also hinted that there was less or more to his confessions, and still didn't believe he was going to get the electric chair. He thought that the governor was still going to make sure that he wasn't killed. But all that was left, and this is where Sadie comes in again. Sadie is still trying as hard as she can to save her brother's life. And there was only one more option, and that's the State Board of Pardons. They can commute the sentence to life. And there's no U.S. Supreme Court federal issues, his attorneys agree. There's nothing to appeal in terms of there's no issues there to appeal. So this is his only chance as a State Board of Pardons. And they're going to decide fairly quickly.
Yeah, well, they decided that they would go through with the execution. They even got Charlie Goddard, Hannah's uncle who raised her, they even got him to talk to the Board of Pardons, but nothing came of that, and so they finally set a final execution date in August of that year.
Sadie even approached the former jurors to try to ask them for if they would help, and they declined, didn't they?
Right. Yeah. She really did. She really worked. She really went above and beyond to try and get Alfred out of this pickle that he found himself in. But to no avail. To no avail.
Now it's 4 days before his execution. What does he try to do with another inmate while he sleeps? August 15th.
Yeah. They accused him of making an attack on another prisoner. Again, he in the middle of the night comes at him in his sleep, strangling, and so they're kind of making a plea that he wasn't in charge of his faculties, that this was a part of his insanity again, that he would attack a prisoner, mm-hmm. in pretty much the same manner he attacked his wife.
And when he said, too, when he was confronted with the idea that he choked this guy, he said, oh, I never touched the guy. So, again, not knowing what he was doing was sort of his last-ditch effort to prove that he could strangle someone in the middle of the night. That did come up in the court trial as well, that somehow that he didn't know what he was doing, and someone testified to that, that they woke up and it wasn't him and his eyes changed. Yeah. So they attempted to do that, where that he was some Ottoman and wasn't aware of his behavior.
Right.
Murder. Well, you know, as it turns out, there was another case in Hamilton about the same time of a fella who had slit his wife's throat in the middle of the night. And he had the sleepwalker defense, you know, which is what Alvin was trying to use. But I think the other guy kind of spoiled that for him. So that didn't quite fly, you know, that he was sleepwalking and not in control of himself. So, yeah, that came up again.
It's fascinating to when you're reading, you forget the times. You know, when you read about the media's behavior, it's been dispelled, people thinking that the media are now so sensationalistic. No, it's not new. But also just the idea that, that idea that he could, that the same things would be prevalent in today's society, and that being that in 1904, they had the same kinds of ideas for novel defenses like sleepwalking defense. You would think that that would have been something in the 70s, 80s, 90s. No,
right.
1904.
No.
Yeah.
No. Terrible. No. You know, one of the things that strikes, you know, we talk about the 24-hour news cycle here, but I think, you know, how I begin the book with him coming off of the train and meeting that crowd at the Hamilton station, because, you know, it had only been, you know, his brother, King and the detective, it was just the day before that they were in town, and enough people got wind of it then that they had it out by the next morning, and all that crowd showed up, and that's kind of what, you know, I think inspired Alfred to confess to all these murders, was just the celebrity, the instant notoriety that he got, and people were taken with him, and I think he loved that. I think he just enjoyed the attention that he would kick back and tell them these stories. And he had a good memory for them and apparently was a really good storyteller.
Yeah. But it's always, what is the actual truth? And so near the end of the book, at the very end of the book, his sister Sadie comes to visit. And she says, tell me the truth, Alfred. Was your confession true? And then I thought this was incredibly poetic. And in the shadow of the gallows, will you tell me the truth? And what does he say in terms of, was it truth?
He tells her that the only murder that he committed was that of Hannah.
And what does she say?
What?
She almost collapses when she hears that, when he says, right, I'm only guilty of Hannah.
Right. Yeah, he was still thinking that he wasn't going to go to the chair, though. But, she showed up, and she was, I think she was quite relieved, actually, that he didn't do all those things, but even as if killing Hannah wasn't bad enough, right?
Yeah, yeah. But she had such faith in him that if he did do it, he was insane. She just didn't want to believe that he was capable of this. There is, you call it one last confession, a person named J.B. Sims, regarding Joe Roth. They discussed Joe Roth and the guilt of Joe Roth. What did Alfred Knapp say about that, and what did he offer to do?
Well, he confessed that he said that... In his note that he wrote to Bosch, he wrote it to Bosch, but Bosch never showed up. So he gave it to Mr. Sims. And he said that Joe Roth is innocent of the attack on the two Motzer girls. He says, I done that myself, but there was no intention of committing rape on them. I'm doing this to clear Joe Roth's name as I assaulted the children myself. It was the gist of his note there.
Right. Incredible. Now it's the day before, so that Bosch, Mayor Bosch, shows up at the execution August 19th, 1904. As you write, tell us just a little bit about, I guess, how well that execution went off.
Well, the papers called it the most successful in the history of electrocutions. It was the warden. It was his last execution there at the penitentiary, and there were physicians who knew him, who he had invited to be those that declared him dead. They gave him the full jolt, and he I don't know if he tried to hold his body in that peculiar way to let the electricity roll off
yeah.
of him or not, but it didn't work. It didn't work, and. Of course, they didn't let Sadie in, but she was in Columbus, and she helped take care of the body. And actually, it was quite a big funeral. It said that 3,000 people showed up
wow.
for his services.
Yeah.
But then when they went to the funeral, it was just Sadie, and I think it says one other unnamed companion. And so the family, glad to say the family reconciled. Mayor Bosch returned to Hamilton and shared the confession with the Motzers about the Motzer girls, and he told them that he thought it was true, and so Alfred's kind of career as the greatest criminals of the current era was over, and they buried him there in Columbus. In the prison jail, in the prison graveyard.
Yeah. You add one thing as well, people had contended that Anna May and Alfred Knapp had conceived a child.
Were rumors of that. Yeah, there were rumors of that, but apparently it wasn't true. I mean, how things go, that the Indianapolis News reported that she had to give up the child to the children's guardians because the board being of the opinion that she wasn't a fit person to care for the child. But I think when you sit down and look at, when the child was born, he would have been safely ensconced in the Hamilton jail time the baby
right.
would have had to have been conceived. So it was not possible for him to have fathered a child. So she did remarry. Later on, but she died, became a widow again, and actually she married another time, and then she died while she was in her 30s.
Yeah. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about the first celebrity serial killer in Southwest Ohio, Confessions of the Strangler, Alfred Knapp. Thank you, Richard O. Jones. Is there a website that people might take a look at this book, or tell us about how they might contact you or find out more about your work?
Okay, well, I also do a podcast myself. It's called True Crime Historian. And basically what I do is I pick cases. I think the sweet spot is from about 1870 to about 1930, because as I was researching these, this story and others, I really fell in love with the way that they reported on things back then. They would write in ways that I always wanted to when I was a reporter, but could never get away with. That is, being very descriptive and being very narrative in their approach, in their writing. And today it's all, it's the inverted pyramid and, chunks of facts and not so much storytelling. So I fell in love mm-hmm. with all of that. And so I started doing a podcast called True Crime Historian, where I go through the old newspapers and pull out sections of the case, when they find the body and when they make the arrest and when they interview the girl next door and, all these other things, and pull together a 60 to 90 minute narrative that reads almost like a short story most of the time. When I'm really successful with it, it'll read like a short story, but it's based on all this wonderful newspaper reporting that they did back then. And so I do have a website. It's truecrimehistorian.com, or you can find the podcast on you know, whatever podcast player you listen to. And so I have other tales of murder and mayhem through the ages. It's kind of a wonderful thing to do. I really enjoy doing that. And so I do a story every week, a new story every week.
That sounds fantastic, and I'm sure people, the listeners, will tune in, as I will as well. Thank you so much. The first celebrity serial killer in Southwest Ohio, Confessions of the Strangler, Alfred Knapp. Richard O. Jones, thank you so much for this. It's been an absolute pleasure. You have a great evening.
Thanks for having me, Dan. It's great to be on your show, and I look forward to chatting with you again maybe sometime about some of my other books.
Absolutely. Good night.
Good night.